You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Kosovo celebrates its fifth birthday. But how much change has happened since 2008?
They keep comparing us with Afghanistan, Palestine and Bosnia. It's not much that Kosovo got out from the war and let's help these guys to develop and prosper. But rather that, okay, they had a terrible war and what we should do not to have it again.
We discuss three of the most influential people in modern Germany as we crack the spine on the new Deutsche-themed issue of Monocle. Not all magazines are doing well, though. Reader's Digest is the latest to hit the skids.
They had a core demographic readership who received it via subscription, and they had a very difficult problem increasing the readership because their methods of marketing were weakened by time.
All that plus we discuss trustworthiness in China, catch up with the New York Bureau on President's Day, and talk about counterinsurgency and Syria with the author Max Boot. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. As ever, rather a lot to pack in over the next hour. Before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Demonstrators have been joined in many Pakistani cities, demanding security forces do more to protect Shia Muslims from Sunni extremists. It follows an explosion at the weekend in Quetta, in which almost 90 people were killed. Members of the Shia Hazara community in the city are refusing to bury the dead in protest of what they say is the failure of authorities to keep them safe. Al Jazeera's correspondent in Pakistan, MTS Tiab, says the protest is a powerful statement.
There's a sectarian group which is operating here in Balochistan, a group by the name of Lashkar-e-Jangvi. Its mission is to either push out all the Shias, convert them to Sunni Islam, or frankly kill them. And that's really what's going on the ground here in Balochistan.
The president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, has returned to the country 2 months after traveling to Cuba for cancer treatment. He's had 4 operations since first being diagnosed with cancer 18 months ago. Last October, he was re-elected but hasn't been sworn in yet because of his illness. An investigation carried out for the UN says there's evidence some Syrian leaders could be guilty of war crimes. Hundreds of people who fled the country have been interviewed almost 2 years since the start of the uprising against President Assad's regime. The chief investigator, Carla Del Ponte, says it's time the case was referred to the International Criminal Court.
We were able to identify high-level perpetrators. We will indicate that in a list that will remain sealed, because what we need is that a tribunal is taking care, conducting a formal investigation and issue an indictment.
Police in Bangladesh have shot and killed a protester during renewed demonstrations linked to prosecutions for war crimes. At least 14 people have died so far during demonstrations against the decision to try leaders of the Islamic Jamaat-e-Aslimi party. They have been accused of involvement in murders and other atrocities during Bangladesh's war of independence from Pakistan more than 40 years ago. In France, authorities have eased the restrictions on a firm implicated in Europe's horse meat scandal. Spanghero's license was suspended last week after claims that the firm knowingly sold horse meat labelled as beef, an allegation the company denies. Now it is allowed to produce some products but won't be allowed to stock any frozen meat. Meanwhile, tests continue at a laboratory in Germany after concerns about how widespread the illicit use of horse meat may be. Jens Willer works at the lab.
We were really overwhelmed by the amount of samples we received here in the last days and weeks. At the beginning of the crisis, most samples came from our colleagues in the UK. We even arranged a daily transport by car through the channel here to the laboratory.
Workers at the Spanish airline Iberia have started a 5-day strike in protest of plans to cut jobs and salaries. It's already cancelled around 40% of scheduled flights this week, and knock-on delays will affect hundreds more flights. Iberia wants to cut almost 4,000 jobs after announcing significant losses in the first 9 months of last year. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. It's 20.05 in Helsinki, 18.05 here in London, 11.05 if you're listening in Calgary. You're listening to Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
When it comes to China and the issue of trust, the discussion is normally centred on whether we, the West, or more precisely our leaders, can trust China's top brass. But concerns over trust, or the lack thereof, are, it seems, widely shared throughout the country. A new report suggests that the majority of Chinese city dwellers do not believe that most people can be trusted. A mark of how serious the problem is. The report was written by the state-run Chinese Academy of Social Sciences and printed in the state-run China Daily. Joining me now in the studio is Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Raffaello, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to be here.
We've had over the past year or so numerous corruption scandals at the top of the Communist Party. We've had protests in towns across the country about corruption and other economic issues. There's been lots more focus on censorship by the state. All these things added together with now this issue of trust. I mean, in a sense, this report isn't a surprise, is it?
No, I don't think it is a surprise. But I think what's quite interesting is that of the various institutions you mentioned, a lot of them are sort of government linked or directly part of the government. And interestingly, in terms of the conclusions of this survey, the government seemed to come out best in terms of the most trustworthy institution amongst Chinese people. And in fact, the ones that came out worse were private corporations and companies. So, I mean, in a way, the conclusions of this report are quite traditional in some ways, you know. I mean, you're reaching a conclusion whereby the government is still, you know, it's, I think it was around 60-something percent of the population who, of those interviewed, who said that the government was the most trustworthy institution amongst the various that they were asked to. And then business came after that at sort of 50-something.
So it's intriguing, yeah, though, that people don't trust people.
Yes, yes, that is fascinating. And I think it plays into this sort of rush to urbanization and this sort of rush to development that you've seen in China, and it's starting to have repercussions. This sort of lack of trust amongst people, I mean, I lived in China for about 3 years, and one of the most sort of amusing things you would get constantly from Chinese colleagues was they would forward these emails that were circulating about poisoned food. And so every week there was another food that you couldn't eat. And this is about, you know, there's a lack of trust in where your food's coming from even. Mm. And so people wouldn't trust the company, so they go and grow it themselves. And then, you know, individuals sort of not being supportive of each other. Well, you know, if you're in a city of 23 million people like Shanghai, there's only a certain amount of good jobs out there that you can get. So there's a lot of hot competition for that. So there's a sense of, you know, I always must get one over the guy next to me, which isn't very good for sort of social harmony.
You mentioned urbanization, the rapid urbanization that China's experienced. Is part of the problem here exactly that, and that people have left behind pretty close-knit communities where their family were all close to them, where they knew all their neighbours and knew pretty much everyone who lived near them, and now millions and millions of people have left that and moved to a big city where they may not know the other people that live in their apartment block?
Yes, I think that's true, but I think that's sort of a universal issue. I mean, I think when in the article someone mentions, or in an article about this report, someone says, you know, well, you know, this is what happens when you're in a big city, you know, it's very depersonalizing in some ways. And I think the interesting thing about within China is that actually family units are still very strong. There is still this sense within the broader society that you do need to look after yourself, and you can't rely on the state to be the one who'll provide you with a pension and welfare in the future. And that's much more reliant on the family family net. So in a way, while on the one hand, this sort of rush to urbanization has led to this maybe depersonalization of the people you know around you, there is still a very strong sense of familial links within the society.
So is this, sad as it may be to suggest it, just the sort of thing that you expect to happen in a country that is developing?
That would be my conclusion to some degree. I also think it's a question of a country that is rapidly modernizing. And at the breakneck speed that China is and some of the social policies that they try to implement, the one-child policy, for example, and some people have ascribed that to part of this loss of trust amongst society. Because if you have these sort of family units where you have the parents and then the grandparents, so you have six adults doting on one child, it creates what they call the little emperor syndrome. And so you get these very spoiled children. Now, that's when you're a child, you're spoiled. If you get
some
to your
single
teeth.
Children, I know would argue that, you know, just because they're a single child doesn't mean they're spoiled.
That's very true. I think we're talking a very specific context here. You know, I had a brother, so I don't know anything about this. But this does create a sense of very deep personal entitlement, which then multiplied by living in these big, massive cities that are sort of constantly growing and there's sort of very few good jobs. Everyone wants to get the best one and the sort of push and then these vast societal divisions that you see.
The fact that this report was commissioned by a state-run body was printed with no problem by the China Daily, a state-run paper. Does that to you suggest that they realise it's a problem and they want to deal with it, or in a sense the opposite, that, well, this is just what happens and that's fine?
No, I think there is a sense that they want to deal with it. I think there is a very strong sense amongst the new administration that's coming in, the Xi Jinping leadership, that there are some fundamental problems in the country that they need to address and they need to figure out how to deal with them. And so by coming out with them in this sort of way and talking about them, like he's been talking about corruption quite a lot, it's a signal to the people that we are aware of these problems and we're trying to do something about them. I think the real fundamental question is, are they able to do anything about them? And do they actually have the capacity or the levers of authority to actually go and implement some sort of strategy to counter this? I mean, how do you make everyone trust everyone else more? I mean, what can you... It's very hard for me to conceptualize exactly how I would do that. And I'm sure when you multiply that out in the sort of Chinese scale that we're talking about and the complexity, because, of course, I suspect that a lot of people who were interviewed here were probably in large cities. I suspect this maybe trustworthiness or lack of trustworthiness might play in a very different context if you go to a smaller third or fourth tier city.
Let's end by going back to your original point when you said, well, look, actually, the government comes out of this quite well. Mm. Does that surprise you when you look at, you know, what has been over the last couple of years, a lot of fairly public anger towards the government over a whole host of different economic and corruption issues. Mm. And of course, you know, the big issues that we know internationally.
Mm. It is interesting. But again, I would say the thing that's interesting to me is that the government seems to be the one entity that's highlighted as coming out as most trustworthy of the ones in this situation. And often what you've seen in the recent past when these sort of corruption scandals have bubbled up, and recently there have been exceptions to this because you've seen very high-level members of the Politburo get dragged down, is that it tends to be focused at a very local level. And it tends to be the central government that sort of lets local corruption issues get exposed and then sort of uncovered and revealed. And it's sort of a control mechanism in some ways. And I think that sense is something that I think a lot of Chinese people have. And so they may, you know, the way the government tries to sell it is they say, trust us in the center, and it's the locals who are not implementing our strategy. But it's not totally clear to me if that message is always getting through.
Raffaello Pantucci, Senior Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Thank you very much indeed. Up next, Kosovo celebrates 5 years of independence. We're in Pristina.
Europe's first big election of 2013 takes place next weekend as Italy goes to the polls. And on Monocle 24, we've got it covered. All this week, we'll be reporting from across Italy, getting under the skin of one of the continent's most fascinating countries. Every day on The Globalist and The Monocle Daily, we'll analyse the big issues and the even bigger personalities. That's the Italian election, all this week on Monocle 24.
And And you're back with Midori House, just about to turn 18:15 here in London, 13:15 in New York City. There were celebrations in Pristina this weekend as the Republic of Kosovo celebrated its fifth birthday. The ethnic Albanian majority unilaterally declared its independence from Serbia in 2008 and has since enjoyed the support of the United Nations and the European Union. But more than 90 countries still refuse to recognise Kosovo, including Serbia and Russia. And the ethnic Serbs in the north of the country have also rejected government from Pristina. Our correspondent Guy Delaunay has been to both sides of the divide in Europe's youngest country.
There's a party mood here in the centre of Pristina as the city gets ready to celebrate the fifth anniversary of Kosovo's declaration of independence. And at the newborn monument, which spells out the word newborn, people are painting the flags of the 98 countries which have so far recognised Kosovo's independence onto each individual letter of that sculpture.
Not an easy road, a very long road ahead of us. Nevertheless, I think people who have supported Kosovo independence can be firmly proud of our achievement.
Petrit Salimi is the Deputy Foreign Minister of the Republic of Kosovo.
Are there challenges? Are there problems? Well, there are a zillion other problems and there are a zillion challenges. But we do have to take in mind that this is the youngest nation in Europe. A lot of things which were fixed in England 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 200, we are just now doing them. We are now establishing for the first time a central bank and a constitutional court and a system which is respecting the minorities. The legal framework is very progressive. And I do hope that just like the legal framework allows it, that this is going to become a truly liberal democracy that the citizens will be proud of.
Kosovo is indeed still a nation under construction. The conflict of the late 90s damaged industry and infrastructure, and a controversial privatization program that followed independence seems to have done little to help. International players have been here in force with missions from the United Nations and the European Union, and the United States has been highly influential. So-called supervised independence ended last year, but the international presence is still significant. Petrit Salimi doesn't view that as a problem.
Thank God we have friends. We are very proud of the support that we have from the United States and all of the EU countries. Self-sufficiency of the old type, I don't think is valid anymore in this day and age. We have received a lot of help, and we have to make sure as a government that this help brings seeds of future, long-term and solid development for the entire country.
That gratitude isn't shared by everyone in Kosovo. 5 years on from the Declaration of Independence, too many things are still missing. Kosovo still doesn't have an international telephone dialing code, and unlike other Balkan countries, its citizens don't enjoy visa-free travel within the European Union. Its sports teams are barred from international competition, and even a place at the Eurovision Song Contest is currently out of reach. Worst of all, there are no jobs. An unemployment rate of 50% is staggering and probably conservative. Opposition leader Albin Kurti says that some of the blame lies with the way international players still treat Kosovo as a war zone.
They have placed us in a shelf where is written crisis. So they keep comparing us with Afghanistan, Palestine and Bosnia. It's not much that Kosovo got out from the war and let's help these guys to develop and prosper, but rather that, okay, they had a terrible war and what we should do not to have it again. This is the main task of international community, and I think that they are too big in size and too small in ambitions for us native people.
Others believe the international presence has bolstered politicians who curry favour with diplomats while neglecting their own people.
Until now, international community was part of the solution in Kosovo. Now it's becoming part of the problem.
Ardian Arifai is the senior researcher at the Kosovo Institute for Policy Research and Development.
You have the international community that prefers having in power politicians that they control, rather than politicians who have capacity to lead the country and lead the society and really improve the situation here. And if the embassies in Western embassies in Pristina call you an enemy of the West or something similar, you're political career is more or less over. On the other hand, if you are favored by the Western embassies here, you more or less, you can count that you have the respect of the and the votes of the voters.
Then there's the other big issue that's not going away. The imposing Serbian Orthodox Church in northern Mitrovica rings out a reminder that not all of Kosovo is ethnic Albanian. The people here form the largest ethnic Serb community in the country, and they reject the authority of Pristina. As far as they're concerned, they're still citizens of Serbia, and they fear that the ethnic Albanian majority wants their land, but not the people living there. Oliver Ivanovic is a Kosovo Serb leader.
We are scared for our kids and our property, scared really, and deeply scared. And we have no electricity, have electricity cutting, have no water on a daily basis, but we are still happy. Because those people are afraid that it could be worse. And they're afraid of the possible political changing, which can make our things to be even more concerned for our life.
People in northern Mitrovica try to make the best of the situation. The beer's cheap, and they gather in packed, smoky bars to listen to local bands. But there's a good reason for the tension here. There are regular incidents of shootings, beatings, and explosions as scores are settled over political or ethnic arguments. That makes northern Mitrovica a tough place to live for people like graphic designer and singer Milan.
You had to grow up earlier here because all the time you're concerned about your life. Every time when you step out of your house, you don't know is there someone waiting on the corner, behind the corner for you, you know, to stab you with a knife, or because those situations are happening all the time. Everything is closed at midnight, you know. There's no people on the street because of situation and your own security.
Change may be on its way. Serbia wants to join the EU, and that means it'll have to compromise on Kosovo. The prime ministers of the two countries have been meeting regularly in recent months, and that's causing concern in both northern and southern Kosovo. The Serbs in the north fear that Belgrade will sacrifice them in the same way that Croatia's Serbs were abandoned almost 20 years ago. But Albanians in the south worry about the creation of an autonomous area that might, as they see it, make Kosovo into another mess like ethnically divided Bosnia. So the party in Pristina wasn't quite the unqualified celebration it might have been. Until the big issues are tackled, there'll still be nagging doubts among the people of the Republic of Kosovo. For Monocle in Pristina, I'm Guy Delorne.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll discover the identity of some of the most influential Germans. You're listening to Midori House. And now the new issue of Monocle has arrived here in Midori House, and it will be on newsstands around the world by Thursday. Subscribers, of course, should find it on their doormats even earlier. On its front cover is an unexpected symbol of German excellence, the Haribo gummy bear. And its presence there highlights the fact that the theme of this issue is the modern Germany. All this week on Midori House, we'll be delving into the new issue, looking at some of the people and products that best sum up Europe's biggest economy. And to kick off the issue, we chose 12 people that we believe represent modern Germany, from a television star to a language teacher. Our Berlin-based contributing editor Marcus Albers chose many of them, and he joins me now to discuss the Deutsche Dozen. Marcus, welcome to Midori House.
Hello, Steve.
Now, before we talk about some of the 12 people that we chose, talk me through the process of coming up with these people. Obviously, we spoke for quite a while, and we included Kimberly Bradley, our Berlin correspondent, some other friends of Monocle who know all about Germany. What were the particular things that you were looking for in the choices that you suggested?
Well, we were looking for influential Germans. Now, it's probably a bit hard to define influential, but we were looking at people that may not even be that well-known in Germany, but that in their respective area move things ahead and help change things. So we tried to tell stories about people that may even to German readers be new and interesting.
Well, I certainly hope they are. Let's talk about three of the people that we end up choosing: Mitri Sirin, Gabor Steingart, and Karolina Seifert. Let's start with Mitri Sirin. He's a TV presenter, but he's a bit more than that, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he's an unlikely face on German television because he was born in Germany, but he's from Syrian parents. So he's not the blonde and blue-eyed type that you would expect on German television, and that actually still is on German television a lot. So Mitri Sirin, he's a super smart young TV host. He's hosting the Daily Morning Journal, but, you know, he has black hair, he looks Syrian, and for German television, this is pretty unusual.
It is. I mean, he even says, you know, in the interview that you do with him, he says himself, you know, that he often has to answer questions about his ethnicity, which, you know, he feels that his colleagues at the BBC or CNN don't. I mean, do you think this is a welcome sign that he's become such a popular face on German TV, but do you think the fact that his ethnicity is still an issue that is talked about suggests that Germany still has a little way to go?
Well, Germany has become much more cosmopolitan in recent years. Yeah, but still, I mean, Germans still tend to ask, where are you from? I mean, there's always this topic, even between Germans from East and West Germany, where people may wonder, is this TV host from the former East, maybe? So people do ask. They just don't take it for granted that they live in a multicultural society. Not yet.
Let's stick with the media and move on to Gabor Steingart, who's the editor-in-chief of Handelsblatt. Now, when we first talked about, you know, having a newspaper editor or someone from the print media, we talked about, well, should we have someone from Der Spiegel or from Stern? But you were quite clear that if we wanted to look at the new Germany, the modern Germany, then it had to be Gabor Steingart and Handelsblatt. Why was that?
Well, I mean, Handelsblatt is the number one daily business newspaper in Germany. So if you ask politicians or managers what do they read, they would probably answer Handelsblatt today. They may not have answered that 2 or 3 years ago because Gabor Steingart was appointed editor-in-chief about 2 years ago. He's now publisher, actually, of Handelsblatt, and he really turned the paper around. It was a little bland, a little boring, but now it has great reporting, great stories, and if you just board any flight in Germany, you will see the front rows of seats, at least. All of them are reading Handelsblatt.
And it's interesting that off the back of, as you say, strong reporting and interesting opinion pieces, circulation has actually risen under Steingart.
It has, but it's also interesting to talk to Steingart about the relationship between print and the digital products he's publishing. Germans do still read many newspapers and many books on paper. It's a country where this is still very much a daily thing people do. But then again, Gabor Steingart invested quite a lot of money into great iPad editions of the Handelsblatt. And he believes that Germans read so much is more about a culture of reading and not so much about a culture of, you know, worshipping paper. So I'm afraid to say he does also believe in the iPad and all those other tablets.
That's quite all right. We can forgive him that. Now let's move on to the final person I want to focus on today, and that's Karolina Seifert, who's responsible for product design at Deutsche Telekom. Now, you know, as you point out in your piece, you know, a couple of decades ago, Deutsche Telekom was, you know, it was a state-owned monopoly and it wasn't really doing very well. She's been one of the key figures in really sort of changing its direction over the last few years, hasn't she?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember when I was young, the Deutsche Telekom, back then they just sold phones and they just, you know, they provided your landline and that was it. Today, Deutsche Telekom is a bit more like, you may say, like Apple maybe. For a typical German, all things he does digitally and in terms of communication, he usually does via Deutsche Telekom. So you will use apps on your iPhone and you will go to websites and et cetera, et cetera. They will sell you your smartphone. So the way these things work together are just so super relevant. And Karolina Seifert believes that today design is becoming more and more important in terms of business success, because if things look great and are really easy to use, then people would use them.
Marcus Albers, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. That was a flavour of the 12 modern Germans that you can read in the new issue of Monocle. It's out later this week. It's the affairs lead. It starts on page 37, and those are three of our 12. Marcus, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. And we're going to keep things slightly German. This is the Beatles with I Want to Hold Your Hand, not in English. And that was the German version of I Want to Hold Your Hand, which the Beatles, I think, recorded live. Exactly where and when, I'll find out later in the show. In the next half hour of the programme, we're going to ask why Reader's Digest is going broke, and we'll also talk guerrilla warfare with Max Boots. But first, here's Paul with headlines.
There have been demonstrations in many cities in Pakistan to demand security forces do more to protect Shia Muslims from Sunni extremists. It follows the explosion at the weekend in the city of Quetta, in which almost 90 people were killed. Members of the Shia Hazara community there have refused to bury the dead in protest of what they say is the failure of authorities to keep them safe. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez is back in the country 2 months after he travelled to Cuba for cancer treatment. It's his fourth operation since he was diagnosed with cancer 18 months ago. It's still not clear when he'll be sworn in for his new term as president. He was re-elected last October, but the ceremony was delayed because of his illness. An investigation carried out for the UN has said there's evidence that some Syrian leaders may be guilty of war crimes. It's after interviews with hundreds of people who've fled the country. Prosecutors have said it's time the International Criminal Court was involved. In Bangladesh, police have shot and killed a protester during renewed demonstrations linked to the decision to prosecute opposition leaders for war crimes. So far, at least 14 people have died during demonstrations against the decision to try leaders of the Islamic Jamaati Islami Party over allegations of murders and atrocities during the War of Independence from Pakistan in 1971. And a five-day strike has started at the Spanish airline Iberia. It's in protest of plans to cut jobs and salaries. The airline has already cancelled around 40% of its scheduled flights for this week. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. It's 2032 in Istanbul, 1832 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Insurgency, insurrection, revolutionary war, guerrillas. There are 1,000 names to the idea of a group of citizens or soldiers rising up with arms against a government. And there are even more variations, from Mao Zedong's People's War to the Islamic radicals of today. And just last week in Mali, following the rapid French sweep in the north, we've witnessed the potential outbreak of yet another such conflict. Max Boot is the author of a new book on the subject, Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. Monocle's Tom Edwards spoke to Max and asked him if the French should have learned from their historical experiences in Algeria with regards to their recent intervention in Mali.
Absolutely. I think that there are lessons that the French should have learned from Algeria, and I hope and trust that they have learned from Algeria, the big lesson being brutality alone is not going to win any counterinsurgency campaign. In addition to trying to defeat the rebels at gunpoint, you also have to offer legitimacy. You have to offer something positive to the people in order to get them to support the security forces. The French completely failed to do that in Algeria in the 1950s when they were basically asking the Algerians to fight for a continuation of French colonial rule. It's not a surprise that they lost, because that was not a very popular thing for Algerians to fight for. Now, in the case of Mali, the challenge for the French is going to be that if they pull their troops out from some of these cities that they have recently recaptured from the Islamists, will there be security forces coming in behind them and a government coming in behind them that can have legitimacy to hold on to those gains and to keep the Islamists out? And those are very big question marks.
Now, that sort of prompts me to think about, you know, the lessons learned from history. And reading a book like Invisible Armies, obviously, it is a history. There's so much. It's very hard to read it and not to think of its applications in the modern world. Looking at, in particular, I guess, in terms of the US and counterinsurgency operations, recently you could suggest that in Iraq it worked pretty well, in Afghanistan arguably less well. Was that a failure to learn the lessons of history, do you think?
I don't think it was a failure so much as to apply some of those lessons, the big one being that these wars are protracted. They take a long time. And attempts to try to short-circuit the process by flooding a lot of troops in often backfire by creating more enemies than you eliminate. The key to ultimate success is to have strategic patience and understand that these campaigns in the post-World War II era tend to last an average of 10 years. That's an average. Some are longer. In the case of Afghanistan, it's going to be longer because the Taliban, the primary foes that the West faces, have secure sanctuaries in Pakistan. And having those kinds of sanctuaries has always been the biggest determinant of failure or success in any kind of counterinsurgency campaign. And so I think we have to understand that this war is not going to end in 2014 when NATO pulls its troops out. And unless NATO continues to provide substantial support to the government of Afghanistan after 2014, I don't think there's much chance of long-term success because of these sanctuaries that the Taliban will continue to enjoy for years to come.
So how does the modern military then respond to that kind of dynamic? Because you've got this whole concept of asymmetric warfare, often these smaller groups that can be very effective against the traditional military powers. How's it changed then the kind of the narrative of military action? Is it even right that, you know, America and Western European powers are investing huge sums of money in big ticket military items? Is that the way to go when so many conflicts are now fought on these kind of terms?
There is definitely a cultural predilection in all conventional militaries, whether in the United States, Britain, or elsewhere, to prepare for wars against other conventional militaries, because those are the kind of enemies that professional soldiers would prefer to fight. But unfortunately, soldiers don't get their choice of enemies. They get sent into the wars that come their way. And most of the wars that have come their way throughout history, as I argue in my book, Invisible Armies, have been irregular conflicts. That always has been and always will be true, but there is always a deep reluctance on the part of professional militaries to prepare for these kinds of conflicts. And so that when they're actually thrust into harm's way in places like Afghanistan or Iraq, they are often shockingly ill-prepared. Now, I would hope that we would actually learn for once the lessons of history and go forward in the future and take the lessons learned from the last decade of war, during which the U.S. Army, the British Army, and other forces have become very good counterinsurgency forces. I would hope they would take that skill set and apply it to the future, but my concern is they will not. They will instead walk away from counterinsurgency as the U.S. Army did after Vietnam. And the next time they're forced to fight this kind of war, they will unfortunately once again be ill-prepared.
It's interesting looking at then the sort of agenda for the people who are prosecuting these kind of guerrilla campaigns on the other side, in terms of how they assess success. I mean, you sort of allude in the book to this notion that maybe only one in five times it's actually successful, but it's quite a vexed question about what a victory, if you like, is. Do you think the fact that the people who are involved in these kind of insurgent activities, they only need to be successful once, I guess. Is that one of the problems, that it doesn't matter if the odds are somewhat stacked against them? They can make the capital they need from the occasional success.
I suppose there's something to that. Certainly, you know, most insurgent leaders are not very happy to settle for half a loaf. Most of them are, by definition, fairly extremist personalities who want to achieve as much as possible and are not happy for a compromise solution. There are occasional exceptions to that rule. The IRA, for example, did take a compromise settlement in Northern Ireland and did not achieve its ultimate objective of kicking British rule out of Northern Ireland. But that tends to be the exception, not the norm. In other cases, like the FARC in Colombia, they continue fighting, and it's very hard to reach any kind of peace settlement with them because In fact, fighting for them, as for many other groups, is good business. They actually make money out of being guerrillas because in the case of FARC, they have ties to drug smugglers. This becomes a way of life. And so often what they're doing becomes divorced from their ultimate objectives. And they continue to adhere, in theory, to those ultimate objectives. But life for them really becomes about the battle, about supporting themselves. This is the way they live.
And Max, I just want to ask you finally, the book, it's sort of subtitled An Epic History. It certainly is that. Just from a sort of writerly perspective, what's your strategy then when you're coming to sort of tackle the not small task of researching and compiling a book like this? Where do you even get started? It's such a great scope to it, such complexity. How do you even begin to process all your thoughts?
Well, I basically started at the beginning, which means starting at the beginning of time and with the very first guerrilla wars, which were tribal wars fought before the existence of historical records. And then I worked my way up slowly. But the key strategy from a writing standpoint was to research and write each chapter as I went along. I didn't do 6 years worth of research and then sit down and write. I did the research for one area, and then I did the writing and so forth and so on. And I revised. It all took a long time still, 6 years, but it became more manageable as you were doing it one step at a time.
That was Tom Edwards talking to Max Boot, and the book was Invisible Armies, An Epic History of Guerrilla Warfare from Ancient Times to the Present. You're listening to Midori House. Some music first, and then Reader's Digest. Oh, yeah.
The menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks, and the makers behind these experiences. Each week we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries and, of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition, we head to a restaurant uniting the cuisines of often rival countries, Turkey and Greece. We ask how many top chefs in one kitchen is too many, and we'll head to Egypt, where there has been something of a renaissance in the country's food on the fine dining scene.
I think there is a big renaissance in the food service sector in Egypt, and introducing Egyptian, and you know what they call the baladi chic and stuff like that.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Krug.
...1842 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Some music now, and honestly, I didn't choose this. She is from Birmingham, though, and she is brilliant. It's Laura Mavula with Green Garden.
And I'll fly on the wings of a butterfly, as a tree top, down again. Putting my back down, taking my shoes off, walking the car.
Laura Mvula with Green Garden, 1844, almost come to 1845 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Now, what do you think of when you hear the words Reader's Digest? To some, this will conjure the rather painful image of well-thumbed copies of magazines in doctors' waiting rooms. To others, perhaps a wistful sigh at the thought of a venerable old institution of the publishing world. But whatever you think, the reality is stark. The publisher behind Reader's Digest has filed for bankruptcy protection with debts of almost $500 million. So how did it come to this? Well, a little earlier, I asked seasoned media monitor and expert in all things print, Stephen Armstrong, to shed a little light on these gloomy tidings for the Digest.
Been a bit of bad old news the last few weeks, hasn't it? There's Newsweek has pretty much closed down, Time Warner sold off pretty much all of its stable, and now the daddy of them all, Reader's Digest.
Reader's Digest, it's a complicated proposition, but partly because in a way the problems of the magazine are symbolic of the problems of the start of the 21st century. The RDA Holdings, which is the owners, are keen to stress that they think the magazine is making money on a week-by-week basis. What's happened is it's been saddled with so much debt via a series of private equity buyouts in 2007 that it's literally, no matter how well it's doing on a weekly basis, it's struggling to meet its interest payments. So it's filed for bankruptcy for the second time in 4 years and is again hoping to restructure the debt. What has happened in the UK is in the first restructuring, the first filing for bankruptcy, the UK operation was sold off, as were other operations around the world. the magazine is now concentrating on its US sort of arm. And in the UK, we've seen the other UK arm go into bankruptcy just slightly ahead. It's gone in the beginning of January, which does suggest that whilst they may be saying that everything's going well on a week-by-week basis, it does seem a little too much of a coincidence to find that both magazines should seek bankruptcy protection for the same reason, making the same argument. It would suggest there's something more fundamentally wrong.
I mean, there's something very curious about Reader's Digest, even at the best of times, in that because it's on a sort of subscription customer base model, you know, you don't see it on newsstands. You don't really, unless you're a reader, or unless there is one of the times where they're advertising, you can kind of forget it's really there.
And it's the way that it gets to you, the traditional through the letterbox Reader's Digest prize draw, where they would offer you a, you know, multi-million check if you were to open the envelope and then subscribe to Reader's Digest. Post is now essentially largely junk mail. The advent of email as everybody's main method of communication meant it's very difficult for Reader's Digest to reach newer and particularly younger audiences who aren't necessarily as used to getting posts that they'd really genuinely read. At the same time, in certain parts of the world, again in the 21st century, at the start of, that kind of very brusque and very demanding mail shot was legislated against. For instance, again in the UK, it was legislated against in parts, in the rules in certain states of the US began to prevent it from using that kind of tactic. So it became hard to see how you'd get it under the noses of anyone short of going onto newsstands. As we know, it's an incredible cost to make something like a newsstand distribution, particularly in a country the size of America.
Indeed. I mean, they've tried to certainly change the way Reader's Digest is seen over the past few years, and while keeping a sort of its stance as a proper sort of family magazine, tried to give it a little bit more zip. Certainly here in the UK, they got Sarah Sands, who was a former editor of the Sunday Telegraph, who's now back at editing the Evening Standard. She, for a few years, was editing it here and trying to give it a bit more of a kick. Do you think those changes were, you know, perhaps a mistake, or, you know, when you see that it hasn't really picked up from there, or was it sort of a decent attempt at trying to revamp it?
I mean, I think that in terms of the content, it was a decent attempt. It wasn't a bad proposition they put together. The problem was they had a core demographic readership who received it via subscription, and they had a very difficult problem increasing the readership because their methods of marketing were weakened by time. Now, what you found in the UK and in the US with both separate publications is that the change alienated the core demographic. It's easy to cancel a subscription. It's much harder to get someone new to subscribe. So in the US, for instance, the magazine had to go down to 10 issues a year. It was preparing to announce in 2013 that it was coming back with a more soft touch, uplifting spiritual features and lots of features on the military, showing that its core demographic weren't enjoying what they were getting. In the UK, similarly, it's, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, it's not the youngest readership in the world. And so the risk of alienating your core is really dramatic if you can't just grab in a new reader with a poster.
And just finally, it's, as I mentioned at the start, you know, Newsweek has decided to close down its print edition. Time Warner has just sold off everything other than the ones we know, Time, Fortune and Sports Illustrated, and now this issue of Reader's Digest. This does seem to be a little bit of a trend, doesn't it?
Well, I think the magazine business is going through a massive and fundamental restructuring. Interestingly, in the UK, the Periodical Publishers Association published its first across-format ABCs recently, as in circulation would be considered whether it was on iTunes, whether it was on the newsstand, or however people got hold of that magazine. iPad magazines, therefore, would be counted in the same number as the ones you bought in a shop. Now, in certain cases, there are magazines which are doing incredibly well and which will do very well from this kind of thing. One magazine, Grazia, circulation soars as soon as that figure's put together. Other magazines, not so much. You're starting to see people look at what actually works in the new magazine business, particularly considering, for instance, that newsagents are struggling to get passing trade. As smoking goes down, people go into newsagents less frequently. They tend to make impulse purchases less. Your magazines are relying on a dedicated readership. Now, that readership can be incredibly attractive. It can be an upmarket. It can be a selective audience who want that editor's curator's choice. And those are the magazines that are doing well. The more general interest rely on the impulse at the newsstand, those are the ones that are really suffering.
And that was media expert Stephen Armstrong on the demise of the august Reader's Digest. Up next, it's time for lunch in New York. just turned 1851 here in London, 1351 over in New York, which is where we cross right now to our New York bureau to speak to Barrett Austin for a little bit of a light lunch. Barrett, welcome to Midori House, and thank you, first of all, for coming in on a bank holiday on President's Day.
Of course, happy President's Day to you, Steve.
Thank you very much, Barrett. Now, since it's President's Day, let's start by talking about the President. During the State of the Union, he alluded to a new project called the Brain Activity Map Project. This was sort of fleshed out a little bit more by the White House over the weekend. What do we know about this?
Well, as you say, it's something he's only just alluded to, and the White House is now fleshing out a bit. We're likely to hear a lot more about this in the coming weeks. But the basic idea is it's a grand proposal, 10 years, roughly $3 billion that he's likely to be asking Congress for. And the idea is to basically map out the human brain and sort of explore consciousness, get a better idea of how the brain operates. And the illusion that the sort of comparison that this is drawing is to the Human Genome Project, which of course began in the mid-1980s, really took off around 1990, and helped us to have a great understanding of human genetics. But the idea is basically get a better idea of how the brain works, and it will yield manifold benefits, whether from, you know, the understanding of diseases, issues like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, things like that, that are so troubling across the world today.
Now, on the surface, this sounds like the sort of project that pretty much everyone could get behind. It's looking, as you say, you know, trying to better understand some of the diseases which can affect anyone. Is he likely to have broad support within Congress for it, though?
I think so. That's something that I've been curious about, and I'm not hearing a lot of coverage in the U.S. media, both on right-wing or left-wing websites, blogs, newspapers, et cetera, today. But I think generally health issues like this tend to have a bit more bipartisan support. If you look at the issue of some of the diseases that I mentioned, for instance, Alzheimer's disease, it's expected that over the next 40 years, Alzheimer's will cost the U.S. some $20 trillion. So when you start adding up those sort of figures, it's likely that members of his own party will support this through and through. But when you start looking at the actual public health benefits that could come from this, and the fact that so many pharmaceutical companies are likely to reap tremendous benefits from this, I think it is something that, while the $3 billion over 10 years is a bit staggering, I think it's something that he is likely to receive, or at least I'd like to think he'll receive widespread support for.
And just finally, sticking with political issues, there was a big protest in Washington, D.C. this weekend over the Keystone XL pipeline project. It's one of those things. I mean, Barack Obama decided against making a decision before the last election. Many people thought because he didn't want to annoy either side, either environmentalists or big business. He's going to be making a decision at some stage soon. These protesters were trying to get him to prevent it happening.
Like you said, there were some 40,000 people who showed up on the National Mall this weekend. It's a big issue, and it has become a huge thorn in President Obama's side. On both sides of the fence, you have environmentalists, ranchers, landowners, social activists who are completely opposed to the idea of any further expansion of the existing Keystone Pipeline project. But on the opposite side, you have Canadian provincial governments, you have the Canadian government, nationally speaking, members of the oil industry who see tremendous benefits from the idea of expanding the Keystone Pipeline and opening up the new routes through Montana, through Oklahoma, and down through Texas. But it's something that he has a bit of a funny past with it. Initially, it was something that he seemed to support. You have to look back at when this was all sort of brought about and brought into the American consciousness. Back in, say, 2009, 2010, we were still deep in a recession. So the idea of anything that would add any money, any jobs throughout the sort of heartland of America, it was something that was very popular.
And obviously, yes, perhaps things have changed a little bit now. Barrett Austin, Monocle's associate editor in New York City. We're going to have to leave it right there. You're listening to Midori House. And we're going to end with a monologue. Daniel Giacopelli sees the growing guerrilla threat in Mali, but argues that it's nothing the French haven't dealt with before.
The attack unfolded before dawn. Dozens of military and civilian targets were hit by insurgents in this vast expanse of land in the North African desert. The French authorities were caught off guard. 7 people were killed. Given last week's events in northern Mali, you'd be forgiven for thinking this was an intel report from a French officer in Gao, or a line item in François Hollande's rather lengthy and expanding to-do list. But no, this was Algiers, 1954, and those killed in the early morning hours of All Saints' Day were the first of at least another million or so to perish in the nasty War of Independence that followed. While 20th century Algeria and modern-day Mali are wholly different beasts, one an ordered yet bubbling cauldron of colonialism, the other an unstable land of Islamists, the French seem to be witnessing another guerrilla war unfolding under their watch in the Sahara, 60 years on. Like their politically minded brethren in Algeria, the jihadists in Gao struck at night, only weeks after airstrikes sent them fleeing to the mountains. They crossed the Niger River in darkness, catching Malian and French troops in a gun battle. This after attacks by suicide bombers at a northern checkpoint. Few now doubt that an insurgency is at hand. The remote mountains of the north are almost tailor-made for such a conflict. The question now is whether France has the stomach to stick it out and finish what they started, or to pull out as planned. This has become the all-too-common devil's choice of our war-prone world, to try and fix things or get out before it's too late. The commanders in the fields and consultants in the Elysee Palace are no doubt weighing the pros and the cons of each move. If an African replacement force is foregone and Paris does indeed double down, this is where things get interesting, for the French have more experience with guerrillas than any other European army. The father of modern counterinsurgency theory was French, and let's just say that in practice it's been a far cry from hearts and minds. For reasons why, I humbly submit the following reading list. Max Boot's new Invisible Armies for a primer on guerrillas throughout the ages. For a fictional account of the pre-Vietnam War mess in French Indochina, Graham Greene nailed it in The Quiet American. And look no further than Alistair Horn and his A Savage War of Peace for a detailed, highly uncomfortable, and classic narrative of the 8-year insurgent war of torture and terror in Algeria. President Bush read this one during the occupation of Iraq. Take from that, of course, what you will. For Monocle, I'm Daniel Giacopelli.
And that's all we have time for on today's show. Thanks to our producer, Hannah Jenkins, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Barbara Feeney, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Next up on Culture with Rob Bound, we're heading down under to Tasmania to see what went on at its arts festival, Mona Foma.
We had a drummer who was submerged in the Derwent and playing underwater for 15 minutes, thrashing away with metal drumsticks on a kit that had hydrophones on it with a scuba mask on.
In 3 hours' time, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be back for the Monocle Daily. I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. For now, though, I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.